I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and driving about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and calling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. About some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a hard fight. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fog and keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight inside me.
When you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Good song there by Merle, but a lot to talk about tonight. Yesterday, I started off by noting I didn't start off the second half of the program. I talked about the death of Ernst Sundel. Ernst was an amazing man, an amazing innovator, an amazing communicator, and a man who did so much to begin to sink the so-called the new religion of Holocaust. And I was talking a little bit about his early life. He was an immigrant from Germany, came to Canada when he was 19 in 1958, was a gifted graphic artist and photo retoucher, and was much in demand. He started work with Simpson Sears in their art department and then branched out on his own. He formed his own business. He started in Montreal and then later moved to Toronto and was very, very successful. And up until his political involvement, he was quite a wealthy man. Of course, years of political fighting, court cases, publishing and so on, reduced his wealth considerably, even though he got a lot of donations as well. But what he was put through was terrible. Anyway, to pick up the story, in Montreal, Ernst, who had been relatively apolitical, grew up in a Seventh-day Adventist family, so he was against war, and he chose Canada rather than the United States because we did not have conscription. As the United States did back in the 1950s, or the draft, I should say. So Ernst came to Canada and was doing very well. He got married. And while in Montreal, he met a man named Adrien Arcand. And Arcand had was a major French-Canadian nationalist. He was interned during the Second World War as a because he was a supporter of Mussolini. He did not believe Canada should be in the Second World War, but in retrospect, he was right, of course. Anyway, Arcand was now an older man, and in reduced economic circumstances. He'd been a very popular journalist before the war, but after the war, well, you know, the losing side doesn't always fare that well. So he was, as at least one Jewish spokesman reveled in a speech we heard. This was Bernie Farber some years ago. We taped him at York University, absolutely reveling, I would say near orgasmic, at the fact that Adrien Arcand died in poverty. In fact, in a very short speech, he mentioned that twice, as if this was very significant. Well, Adrien Arcand, according to Ernst, showed him what it meant to be a German. In other words, he said he taught him how to be a German. What he did is he taught him history, and he filled him in on the history of conspiracies, the true history of the last couple of centuries. Anyway, Ernst moved to Toronto and continued his business, doing well. He bought an impressive place on Carleton, 206 Carleton Avenue, in what's called Toronto's Cabbage Town. This was an old brownstone, he turned that into his home. And later on, it would be his headquarters, and at one point, it would be called the Zundel House. H-A-U-S house is in German. So in the mid-1970s, Ernst was approached by other Germans of his generation, the Germans who had come to Canada and in many cases had done well. Many of these people were tradesmen and skilled tradesmen, and they were of course much in demand. Germany had a superb, in those days, had a superb education system. And these people really brought skills to this country that were badly needed, and they did well. They were Germans were hardworking people, and put their nose to the grindstone. Didn't expect the world didn't expect the world to support them, and so on. And so they made great employees and good employers, and did well. Well, Ernst. Was approached by some of these Germans because in the middle of the 1970s, the new religion of Holocaust began to organize or codify. Prior to that, there had been stories about World War II, wild exaggerations. At first, there was 11 million Jews who were killed by the National Socialists. Then it was 7, and then it kind of became 6, and there were wild stories about lampshades made out of Jewish skin and shrunken heads and things like that. But beginning with the television series called The Holocaust, this began to take on a much clearer form of religion and build up a lot of support and followers. Enough pressure that the American government would give prime land in downtown Washington for the building of a National Holocaust Museum, bigger than many American monuments. And when you think about it, this was a museum about things that may or may not have happened to people who are not Americans in another country, perpetrated by other people. Extraordinary. It will be similar to building a big museum in downtown Washington to commemorate the conquest of the Irish people and the brutality they suffered under Oliver Cromwell. Well, I think a person would object, well, first of all, why should the American government be involved? It didn't happen in the United States. the people to whom it happened were not Americans, and the perpetrators were not Americans either. Well, like, what's it to us? Anyway, the new religion of Holocaust gathered a lot of momentum, and unfortunately, and I've got to say this about my former profession, I was a teacher. A lot of teachers, frankly, are not very bright, and there's some teachers who are, frankly, not very nice. So German children were coming home in tears. The teacher had said, the Germans massacre, or the Germans holocausted or exterminated, 6 million Jews. The Germans did this, the Germans did that. And, these sort of broad characterizations, I say stupid people do that, stupid people. Naturally, hurt the feelings of these little children. I mean, Heidi in grade two, what does she know about the Second World War? But suddenly her little friends are pointing fingers at her and saying, your people, you killed all these people. Well, these kids are coming home in tears. So the parents didn't know quite what to do. For many of them, English was not a language in which they were really comfortable. It was not, it's not their first language. That didn't mean they couldn't speak it, but they didn't feel comfortable in public confrontations or public presentations. Also, as Ernst and others have pointed out to me, most of the people who came to Canada after the Second World War were more skilled workers, the skilled working class. They were not, for the most part, intellectuals or communicators. That was not their thing. But Ernst was. So Ernst was a very gifted communicator. So they turned to Ernst. Oh yes, well, what I should say before I get to that. In 1968, a young Ernst Zundel ran for the leadership of the Liberal Party, the same year that Pierre Trudeau did, and of course Trudeau would win. He withdrew at the last minute, but not before he'd had a chance to make a speech. And in that speech, you could already see the Ernst Zundel of 10 years later. He made a plea for better treatment of Germans in Canada, that there was a lot of prejudice against Germans. Already seen as the leader of his people. Anyway, German folks in and around Toronto approached Ernst and asked him if he would assist them in fighting back. And so he formed the Concerned Parents of German Descent, and they would go to schools and school boards and talk to teachers and talk to the administration. They also picketed movies like The Boys from Brazil, which is a really anti-German, it was an anti-German movie from the late 70s. And they picketed the Toronto Sun, which, despite the fact it's a right-wing, supposedly, paper, has been very, very anti-German over the years. In fact, its editor, Mark Bonakowski, today, and that's Monday, the 7th of August, wrote a column that is truly disgusting. And he concludes it with the fact that he regrets that Ernst Zundel did not die in agony, that he was passed away relatively benignly from a heart attack. Now, it really takes something to behave, to write like that. Anyway, Concerned Parents of German Descent was something, it was a group that Ernst formed, and he had pickets, and I remember participating in a couple of myself with him, but he felt that he had run into a brick wall, and Ernst always said of himself, there's one law for everybody else, and then there's a special law for Ernst. And this was his rather wry summary of his experiences with the Canadian justice system, that what would be fine for one group would not apply to German, to him. And it was the same with Germans. Had it been another group, and I would say, well, that's hypothetically, Albanians. Supposing things were said by teachers that were very broad and nasty about Albanians, not making distinctions between the government and the people. The Albanians are savage, they did this or that to somebody. and if Albanian parents went to the school or school board, the board would probably be sympathetic and say, well, the teacher overspoke herself or misspoke herself, or, you know, has got to be more careful. If the teacher's recalcitrant, the board might well punish that teacher or fire that person. But not so with the Germans. And what Ernst came to realize was that hanging over all of this was the so-called Holocaust, which in a way justified mistreatment of Germans. Because you people did the so-called Holocaust. That's where this new religion of Holocaust is so insidious. It's not just the self-serving account by a group of its tribal history. That's fine. The tribe can believe any old thing it wants. But it's something that is imposed on us. So Ernst believed that the only way to really get justice was to do something about this religion of Holocaust. And he already knew that many of the claims were, frankly, exaggerated or just plain bogus. So how do you go after that? Well, Ernst knew that there had been critics of the so-called Holocaust story from the very beginning. One was a French socialist named Paul Racibier. And in the 1950s, when material came out talking about Auschwitz and horrible things done, Paul Racibier, who you have to remember was a man of the left, he was not a Jew, but a man of the left, he'd been in Auschwitz, and he wrote a book where he said, this isn't true. I was there. I know. I didn't get gassed, and nobody tried to gas me, and I didn't see any gassings or extermination. What you're being told is not true, and I know because I was there. And then others came along, and there was sometimes called a pamphlet, but it's more like, say, Time or Maclean's magazine, that format, about 30-some pages. It was by a man named Richard Verrall, and it was called Did 6 Million Really Die? And it was the first work of scholarship to seriously begin to attack one of the core claims of the new religion of Holocaust, and that's the 6 million figure. And of course, many people found it odd that as evidence came about that perhaps 6 million was an exaggeration, or we won't even say a lie, but an exaggeration, or not the fact, that the Holocaust lobby would not just gracefully retreat and say, okay, yes, that figure was exaggerated, or it was a mistake, but so the true figure is such and such. That would have been an end of it, actually, because mistakes happen. And it has always struck me as particularly bizarre that people would want there to be more deaths. You know, if you could prove that 6 million had not died, that it was a much smaller figure, wouldn't that be good news? It doesn't mean that no Jews died in World War II or anything else, but why not accept that, well, okay, the original allegations were exaggerated, or false, or whatever, this is the true figure, and move on. I mean, that's what history is all about, a constant revision. As we learn more facts, sometimes from documentation, sometimes from diaries, sometimes from long overlooked eyewitnesses, sometimes from forensics or from archaeology, the interpretations of history are constantly changing. It doesn't mean there's no truth and no falsehood, but there are changes. Anyway, such was not the case, though. That figure, 6 million, was hung on to fanatically. And people who questioned it term was invented, called Holocaust deniers. And they were seen to be evil people, or alleged to be evil people, or attacked as such. And the reason was that the Holocaust lobby, I guess, feared that if any part of their tale proved untrue, people would begin to doubt the rest of it. And I think very foolishly, they hung on to that figure. And the battle was on. But so anyway, Ernst was not an original researcher, but he took this pamphlet, Did 6 Million Really Die, and distributed it by the tens of thousands to media, federal members of parliament, members of the Canadian Senate, politicians at all levels in Canada, important doctors and engineers, widely distributed it. Well, retribution came relatively quickly. First of all, his mailing rights were taken away. That is very, very extraordinary. So for an 8-month period, Ernst Zundel could not legally send or receive mail in Canada. Now, this is a totalitarian aspect of the Canada Post Corporation Act, and it's one that we right now, the Canadian Association for Free Expression, are actively challenging, but in another context. And that has to do with the similar punishment being inflicted on the editor of Your War News, Dr. James Sears, and the publisher of Your War News, Leroy St. Germain. Again, in both cases, no crime had ever been committed, no guilt had ever been found. This was just a way essentially to shut him down. Well, Ernst responded aggressively to the courts and got his mailing rights back. So with the distribution of Did 6 Million Really Die, efforts were made by the Holocaust Remembrance Society and a particularly nasty woman named Sabina Citron. Now, Sabina allegedly, she was a Latvian Jewess and allegedly been to one of the detention camps, and she had a special hate on for Ernst Zundel. She was not a nice person on many levels, but one of the very unnice aspects of her character was she was owned a factory which had mostly third world employees, and there were the factory was on numerous occasions cited for labor violations. You know, they weren't very nice. She wasn't a very nice person anyway. After much agitation, finally in 1983, Ernst Zundel was charged under a very, very obscure law called the False News Law. And it was a law that I don't think had been actually prosecuted for over 100 years. In fact, I believe I read that it had actually not been prosecuted since before Confederation in 1867. The false news law basically said that it was a criminal offense to deliberately mislead the public through false news, for commercial advantage. Because first of all, it had to be deliberate, and it had to be news. And what it was aimed at was in simpler times. If you could spread a rumor, say through a small newspaper, that let's say the grain crop that year in England was the harvest looked very, very good. Well, if you were a Canadian wheat grower, you might say, "Oh my gosh, the price of wheat's going to really fall. I'd better sell as fast as I can." So you could be panicked into selling your wheat at fire sale prices, and it turned out, of course, that the harvest was bad in England, and the prices for wheat would have gone up, and you're left high and dry. It was that type of thing. It was never meant for historical opinions. But anyway, 83, Ernst was charged. He got a lawyer, Doug Christie, who was then a rising star in British Columbia, an aggressive, very intelligent young lawyer, and I'm going to come the first great Holocaust trial occurred in Toronto for 7 weeks in 1984, and this trial, in many ways, began to destroy the story of the Holocaust. Ernst brought in expert witnesses, and Doug Christie was very aggressive as a cross-examiner. He destroyed many of these so-called eyewitnesses. He tied them in knots because, frankly, eyewitness evidence is often, not always, but often, very very untrustworthy. Especially now in 1984, we're talking of 40 years after the Second World War. Now, memories from 40 years fade. We make mistakes. I mean, how many times in your own personal life have you made a mistake and thought, you know, I'm pretty sure I put that on the counter, and turns out you were wrong, you put it on your dresser, or, well, whatever. You know, a memory with the best of intentions is faulty. Add to that the fact that by now, the eyewitnesses were under a lot of pressure too. There's a new party line. Do you really want to say as a Jew that, well, actually, I was in Auschwitz, and, yeah, it wasn't pleasant, and we had to work, and, yeah, I would rather have been free, but, you know, I wasn't abused. You know, there was a theater in Auschwitz. There was a swimming pool. Well, you don't often hear that, but, so, with the best of good intentions, I'm not saying people even deliberately lied. I'm sure some did, but Doug Christie was a master at cross-examination. He had a way of sneaking up on you. He had a way of seeming to be almost bored and asking the same question seemingly several times, just the same thing, as if he really wasn't even interested in your answer. And then suddenly you get cocky and you contradict yourself and he's got you. Well, he made some of the eyewitnesses look totally foolish. And then there was some expert testimony. And you can still find this in the Toronto archives, I think, of the Globe and Mail. One of the leading experts on the Holocaust, and he was, you know, a self-proclaimed expert. He said he'd been in Auschwitz, and he could tell who was being cremated on any given day by the color of the smoke. It almost sounds like a racial joke. I'm not sure he said this, but it was an Oriental, and there probably weren't many Orientals in Auschwitz, but let's say the smoke was yellow. And if it was a Jew, let's say the smoke was black, and if it was a Italian, the smoke was greasy brown. I mean, it almost sounds like a racial joke. But he claimed he could tell who was being cremated by the color of the smoke. Well, anybody knows that the color of smoke from a crematory, to the extent there is any, is sort of white. And it isn't going to vary as to whether the person being cremated was a Jew or a Pole or whatever. You would think, with such absurdities from the expert, not some wacky eyewitness, but the expert, that the whole Holocaust case would collapse. And if the whole Holocaust story would collapse, well, if the reporting had been consistent, perhaps it would have. Anyway, the first trial ended with a conviction. Ernst appealed. A second trial was granted, it was mandated, which took place in 1984. You already see 5 years, 1988, 5 years. Well, these legal cases gobble up a tremendous amount of money. Transcripts alone, back then perhaps $1.50 a page, and these are triple spaced. Can you imagine how much it costs just for 1 day's testimony, 1 day's court proceedings? And the first Holocaust trial went on for 7 weeks. For the second Holocaust trial, Ernst Sindel prepared very, very carefully with a new team of experts. And he and Dr. Robert Forrest, one of the great French revisionists, worked very, very closely together on this. Well, for the second Holocaust trial in 1988, Doug Christie and Ernst Sindel put together some very interesting experts. One was historian David Irving. And Irving was very well regarded, widely published, and very successful historian at the time. He would later say that testifying at that trial had, well, he would say, ruined his life. Let's say considerably damaged his life, cost him a lot of so-called mainline respectable publishers, and began to campaign of defamation against him, which you know, has cost him an awful lot of money and a lot of reputation and so on. But he, his testimony was vital. For one thing, Irving was a great, scholar for looking at the archives. He likes original sources. Rather than looking at what historian A said and historian B and then trying to come up with a kind of slightly new interpretation, David Irving, as he says, ladies and gentlemen, I go to the archives. And he does. So what Irving testified to was that there was no order. That's right. The Third Reich was a very top-down, bureaucratic, organized sort of place. It wasn't a sort of an institution. It was not people doing their own thing or making things up as they went along. It's a joke, but it was said that you practically needed a written order to be able to go to the washroom. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but the Germans were not prone in the army and other official bodies to doing things without order in a chain of command. The point being that for something this huge, the supposed extermination or near extermination of the European Jews, there was no order. Now, it wouldn't be some rogue commandant in a detention camp that would do this, or some lowly lieutenant. This would have to come from the very top. Well, that's the interesting thing. David Irving had examined the voluminous archives the Americans stole from Germany that are available in Washington, D.C. He visited archives elsewhere, and after the Zwingli trials, a few years later when the Soviet Union collapsed, he would later visit the archives in Moscow. And one of the fascinating things is there is no order. Nor is there any chain of orders. There's no order signed by Adolf Hitler authorizing the systematic extermination of Jews in the detention camps. There's no intermediates, orders, which say somewhat down the line is repeating an order, which would suggest perhaps there was an order lost. No, there's no evidence there ever was a plan to exterminate the Jews of Europe. Well, that's kind of significant. That was huge. Another thing Ernst Zundel did was that the account of gas chambers and crematoria were flawed, were basically wrong. One fact was that in the middle of wartime, when fuel was incredibly scarce in the Third Reich, why would they spend huge expend huge amounts of very rare fuel, very scarce fuel, on cremating bodies? Why not simply, as with massacres done by the communists, in other words, other people in the Second World War, simply dig giant pits, throw the bodies in, and so on. Okay, so what Ernst Zundel did was that he retained the services of a Boston area man named Fred Leuchter. And Fred he's still alive, an unusual skill. He designed execution machines for various American prisons. So he knew a fair deal about how you kill people. And he has quite a lot of interest in engineering, he had a university degree. And so he was sent on a secret mission, as it were, to Auschwitz with a videographer, Jürgen Neumann, a translator, and several other people. Well, they managed to sneak into Auschwitz, and Fred Leuchter took samples of the masonry and the concrete and so on of the so-called gas chambers and the crematoria and so on. And on analyzing them, said, well, there's no it's no evidence of Zyklon B. Like, whatever these structures are, and they didn't claim to have rebuilt them after the war. They claimed that this was the original. It didn't happen. Well, this was huge. Had there been fair reporting, the public would have become aware a lot sooner of this. Anyway, Ernst was again convicted, and an appeal launched, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in 1992, the false news law was thrown out as unconstitutional, and Ernst was a free man. Now, you have to remember, he was charged in 1983, it's now 1992, and he's finally a free man. But that's 9 years of being under parole condition, bail conditions. It's 9 years of huge expenses, and so on. By this time, Ernst was an absolute whirlwind of publishing activity. He published a lot of revisionist booklets and books. He had a studio in the basement of Zundel House where he turned out audio broadcasts and video VHS broadcasts. He was an absolute communication whirlwind. I'm going to come back to that after a short musical interlude. This is Paul Fromm. I'm going to be coming back to my appreciation of Ernst Zundel, who passed away on Saturday at the age of 78 at Bad Wildbach in Germany in the Black Forest. Okay, we're going to take a short musical break here, and why don't we play another Merle Haggard song? Merle made very, very famous, and this was called I Think I'll Just Stay Here and Drink. A little bit of a change of pace.
I would be holding you tonight, but the wrong stop doing high. You don't care about what I think. Think I'll just stay here and drink. But goodbye, don't square the deal. At least you know the way I feel. Take all the money in the bank. I think I'll just stay here and drink. Listen close, you can hear that loud jukebox playing in my ear. No woman gonna change the way I think. I think I'll just stay here and drink. Thank you.
That's Merle Haggard, and I think I'll just stay here and drink. I'm going to play kind of a different tune. This is it's not something nice and positive, and this is called "I Call It Home," and it's about Canada's prairie provinces, and that's the province of Saskatchewan. And just going to try to get that here, and it's called "I Call It Home."
The beauty that my granddad saw, it still remains. From northern forests, lakes and streams, down to the rolling plains, landed by rivers that flow gently past wheat fields standing tall. A canvas rich with color, changes with seasons from winter to fall. Saskatchewan, land of endless prairie skies so blue. Your sunrise takes away my breath, just as your sunsets do. Born here, I choose to stay. You'll never find me far away. Here's where I feel free. Open spaces beckon me, Saskatchewan. The spirit of the pioneer, it lives to this day. An honest handshake, the hard work's done. That's just the prairie way. When times get tough, they pull together to see you through. That's what this province is known for. It's what they gladly do. Saskatchewan, land of endless prairie skies so blue. Your sunrise takes away my breath, just as your sunsets do. Born here, I choose to stay. You'll never find me far away. Here's where I feel free. Open spaces beckon me, Saskatchewan. Friendly faces, country I love to roam. Say you'd call it a dream. I call it home, Saskatchewan. Land of endless prairie skies so blue. Your sunrise takes away my breath, just as your sunsets do. Born here, I choose to stay. You'll never find me far away. Free, open spaces beckon me, Saskatchewan. Here's where I feel free, open spaces beckon me, Saskatchewan.
That's a beautiful song called Saskatchewan with Kathy Graham. And I'll play that one again. Well, not right now, of course, but I think it's just a great upbeat song. I'm going to play one more song for our musical interlude tonight, and hope you like this one. And this is with Buck Owens, Dwight Yoakam, and Patti Loveless.
Ladies and gentlemen, Buck Owens! They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make playing me a big star, 'cause I can play the part so well. Well, I hope you come to see me in my movie, then I know that you will finally see the biggest fool ever hit the big time. All I gotta do is act naturally.
That's Buck Owens, Act Naturally. I'm going to continue my tribute to Ernst Sundell tomorrow, but just like to wrap up tonight. We're now up to 1992. He has won his case after 9 years. Finally is out from restrictions, bail conditions. He has a publishing company called Samizdat, which is generating tons of literature, and I'm going to continue that tomorrow night. Have to cut this one a little short tonight, but back with you again tomorrow. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.